and in 1948, which we had always described as illegal. I could agree that it was important for Kennedy to show boldness not only for domestic reasons, but for real alliance considerations as well. I took the defense of Berlin seriously. I wasn't in favor of invading Cuba or attacking the missiles, nor did I think it would come to that. But even if we did either, I didn't believe that Khrushchev could afford to expand the conflict. That Thursday afternoon, Rostow took me with him from the State Department back to the Pentagon, where he was to meet with a CIA specialist on Cuba. He was interested in expanding the blockade to cover oil and other petroleum products. How long would Cuban supplies of oil last, he wanted to know, before their economy ground to a halt? 6 weeks, he was told. He was excited by that, more it seemed to me than was justified. He said it would mean a ticking clock for Cuba. Back at Rostow's long-range, 2 weeks working group, I wrote a critical memo to him. An alarm, I said, that rang after 6 weeks didn't seem to be related to the timescale we were facing. All the missiles were expected to be operational within days. And the other working group I was on, Rowan's in ISA, contemplated an invasion by the following Tuesday. Moreover, I said in the memo to Rostow, what we had heard of the XCOM meetings that morning, which had led to a message to Khrushchev from JFK, indicated that while we were demanding that work on the missiles be stopped, and the missiles subsequently removed, no deadline was being set. We needed, I argued, to put a time limit on the process explicitly, if we wanted the Soviets to move out, something a lot shorter than 6 weeks, more like days. The transcripts later showed that John McCone, the director of the CIA and a Republican hawk on the XCOM, was making the same recommendation the next morning. And Bobby Kennedy actually delivered a 48-hour ultimatum to the Soviet ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin the following night. I myself, unlike McCone, didn't want an ultimatum to be carried out, and I didn't expect it to be challenged. But I have to admit that I don't recall spending any time thinking about what to do if it were challenged. At 31, I was overconfident that a leader who was outgunned would back down under threat, and that seemed to be confirmed by Khrushchev 3 days on. I wasn't the only one who drew wrong conclusions, as we'll see, about his reasons for doing that. A number of my elders, Rostow and several on the XCOM, McNamara, Bundy, Johnson, and Taylor, among others, applied that mistaken lesson 3 years later to Ho Chi Minh. Friday evening I read a long 6-part telegram from Khrushchev that showed a sober appreciation of the unacceptability of nuclear war between our two countries, and that seemed to offer that he would remove the missiles from Cuba on the basis of nothing more than a no-invasion pledge by Kennedy. That was more or less what I had expected. That night I went back to the hotel to sleep for the first time in 3 days. Like most others, I thought the crisis was about to end. I saw no problem for Kennedy to accept this proposal. As far as I knew, for us to pledge not to invade Cuba was no concession by the United States at all, since we had, I presumed, no intention of invading Cuba except for the presence of the missiles. It was, I supposed, a meaningless face-saving demand that Khrushchev was including to cover the fact that he was retreating without having won anything at all by his adventure. But the next morning, what seemed to be a totally contradictory message arrived, in the clear, demanding the withdrawal of our IRBMs, or officially, NATO's IRBMs, in Turkey as well as the no-invasion pledge. Still, I saw this as just a desperate last-minute attempt at haggling by Khrushchev. The very personal message of the day before seemed to me to show Khrushchev's realistic understanding of the intolerable position he was in. I saw no need to make that alliance-busting trade of missiles, nor did almost any member of the XCOM. The word filtered down to us, confirmed by the transcripts of the discussion years later, that almost every member had strongly urged the president against it, and no indication came to us at the Pentagon that that proposal was delaying our preparations for a U.S. attack 2 days away. On the contrary, from the beginning, President Kennedy had felt sure that if he had to attack the missiles in Cuba, the Soviets would almost certainly retaliate by attacking our missiles in Turkey. General LeMay had disagreed. This was the only occasion I can think of when I agreed with LeMay. With the target date for an attack approaching on Saturday, October 27th, Harry Rowan was asked by Secretary McNamara to lay out for the XCOM alternative options for a U.S. response to a Soviet non-nuclear attack on the U.S. missiles assigned to NATO in Turkey. Harry called me in to work on this with him, and the two of us sat at opposite sides of his desk, each writing on yellow pads as fast as we could. The first option we presented was no further U.S. response, in effect calling it even. Missiles destroyed in Turkey for missiles destroyed in Cuba, seeking to end hostilities there. We took some pride, I recall, in beginning with that, since we felt that few advisers in that era would have had the nerve to even include that as a policy option. Dean Acheson, for one, did not. Along with the next one, to hit the single plane or missile site from which the Soviet attack had been launched, we thought these two options, the first being unlikely to be adopted, were actually best, the only two unlikely to spur further escalations. But we weren't asked for recommendations, only for a range of alternatives. The rest, all likely to be preferred by the JCS to these, followed fairly obviously. In ascending order, retaliate against one Soviet IRBM site, or more than one, or, especially if the Soviets had also attacked some of our bomber bases in Turkey, against several Soviet air bases in the region. If U.S. aircraft were used for any of these, rather than ballistic or cruise missiles, the JCS would demand attacks as well on the surface-to-air missiles and air defenses in the area. If there was a Soviet response, or as the JCS undoubtedly would have recommended, even without it, the United States could attack all the bases, missile sites, and defenses in the region. Or even, Generals Power and LeMay could be counted on to recommend this, full-scale attack on the Soviet Union. That was, after all, what Eisenhower's plan for general war, PSYOP 62, operational until recently, called for in these circumstances. Conflict between armed forces of the Soviet Union and the United States. To be sure, the Kennedy guidance which I drafted changed that. Yet it was pretty much what NATO policy documents had always prescribed. An attack on one, Turkey, was an attack on all, to be responded to as if it were an attack on the United States directly. And NATO planners and heads of state still rejected any notion of waging a war in Europe that treated the superpower homelands as sanctuaries. They still regarded deterrence as resting on an almost immediate launching of a full U.S. attack on the Soviet Union in response to any Soviet attack on an ally. Only days earlier, after all, President Kennedy had promised full retaliation against the Soviet Union as the response to a single IRBM fired from Cuba against the United States. On the other hand, NATO planning and policymaking had never contemplated circumstances exactly like the premise of our draft options, armed hostilities initiated by the United States against Soviet forces inside the territory of a Soviet ally. Some restraint in responding to a limited Soviet retaliation to that might seem in order, but not to SAC or the USAF or the JCS. LeMay, in fact, would be sure to point out that if there were ever an occasion to disarm the Soviet Union before it finally built up its missile forces to the scale SAC had been predicting for years, the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962 was that time, perhaps the last. A Soviet attack on a NATO ally, no matter what the provocation or the views of our European allies, would be an irresistible occasion for it, in the eyes of SAC and LeMay, and perhaps all the Joint Chiefs. I believed it very unlikely that the Soviets would risk hitting our missiles in Turkey, even if we attacked theirs in Cuba. We couldn't understand why Kennedy thought otherwise. Why did he seem sure that the Soviets would respond to an attack on their missiles in Cuba by armed moves against Turkey or Berlin? We wondered if, after his campaigning in 1960 against a supposed missile gap, Kennedy had never really absorbed what the strategic balance actually was, or its implications. As I saw it, and I presumed he did also, Khrushchev was just as outgunned in strategic nuclear forces as he was, obviously, in conventional terms in the Caribbean. That meant to me that he had to back down. The long private telegram from him to Kennedy that I'd read the night before told me that he understood that. What some others in the XCOM, it came out later, had read as panicky on his part, Dean Acheson described it in print as almost maudlin, I saw as sober and realistic. Khrushchev had his feet on the ground, and he knew when a gamble had failed. Ever since Wednesday morning, October 24th, when contrary to his threats on Tuesday, Khrushchev chose not to challenge the blockade line, I hadn't believed it would be necessary to carry out an airstrike to get rid of the Soviet missiles in Cuba. Neither did Harry. I still didn't, as we worked together on Saturday to take account of the repercussions of that possibility. Nor did I believe it was necessary even to consider journalist Walter Lippmann's suggestion Thursday morning of trading away our missiles in Turkey, an option which I, like the majority of the XCOM, it turned out, strongly opposed for reasons of NATO solidarity. That remained my view despite the Saturday morning message from Khrushchev that seemed to take up Lippmann's proposal. Nitza relayed to us the sense from the XCOM that it represented a last-ditch bargaining move dictated by hardliners in the Kremlin, presumably in opposition to his own inclination the night before to concede. Khrushchev could probably overrule that if he remained in control. And Kennedy apparently was banking on that, having decided calmly to ignore that tough demand for a trade in favor of accepting the Friday night message, with no mention of our missiles in Turkey as the ruling proposal. All this was thrown into question by the gradual confirmation during the afternoon that a SAC U-2 over Cuba, which had been out of communication since that morning, had in fact been shot down by a Soviet-manned SAM, and on the U.S. side, by President Kennedy's decision not to respond, contrary to his assurances to the JCS that any shoot-down of a reconnaissance plane would lead to immediate U.S. attacks on the attacking air defense sites and possibly more. That presidential reticence, or as some military we were working with saw it, dismaying weakness, was explained as a desire not to derail Soviet acceptance of his latest proposal, which was sent before the attack on the U-2 had been confirmed. But while the XCOM awaited a Kremlin response, and working groups kept working on plans for air attacks and an invasion now scheduled for 2 days away, a more ominous signal came down to the ISA offices. Harry was given a new task, which he passed on to me. This one came straight from McNamara. I was to draft cables to our ambassador in Turkey, Raymond Hare, and to our ambassador to NATO, Thomas K. Finletter, conveying a presidential decision to remove the U.S. IRBMs from Turkey and replace them with Polaris submarines assigned to NATO in the eastern Mediterranean. As I understood the purpose of these drafts, this was to alert the ambassadors to the possibility, or likelihood, that a presidential decision to this effect would presently be forthcoming. The brief instructions Harry passed on were that the Turks should be told that this would protect them from being targeted by the Soviets, if the crisis escalated, and that the Polaris submarines were a better deterrent to an attack on Turkey or NATO than the IRBMs, which were vulnerable, veritable lightning rods. I was appalled. I had been given a file of previous cable exchanges with our Turkey and NATO ambassadors on the subject of a possible missile trade, missiles being removed from both Turkey and Cuba, and I was entirely convinced by the ambassadors' judgments that this would have a devastating effect on our relations with the Turks and with other NATO governments in general. The Turks, Hare had said in more than one cable, were proud of the possession of the IRBMs, and rather than being fearful of their targetability, they were particularly proud that these missiles put them on the very front line of the NATO military posture. These are now Turkish missiles, Hare said. Indeed, ownership of the missiles, though not the warheads, which the United States supposedly controlled, had been formally transferred to the Turks, which made the United States' unilateral reclaiming of them questionable legally. The Turks had no desire or intention of giving them up, least of all under Soviet threat. Moreover, if the United States were seen as disarming NATO of its weapons in the face of Soviet threats, it would appear to all of NATO that the United States was sacrificing the defense of Europe, its deterrent posture, in the interests of U.S. security. It would be understood as a precursor to a trade-off of the NATO missiles for the removal of the Soviet missiles on Cuba that threatened the continental United States, even though the White House and McNamara proposed to give no hint of this possibility at this time. This precaution they were taking, to keep the missiles from being attacked, and secretly to keep them from being fired by the Turks, was itself more than a hint of that. This would be taken by Charles de Gaulle and others as confirming what he had been saying for some time, that the United States could not be trusted to put European interests with respect to security above its perception of its own security. Leadership of the alliance, which had always amounted to U.S. hegemony, might be lost to de Gaulle or a combination of France and Germany. The alliance itself might begin to dissolve, and Khrushchev could take advantage of this demoralization to press hard on Berlin. All this made sense to me. Although I didn't know it at the time, these same arguments had been pressed on Kennedy that very morning by McGeorge Bundy and others, persuading him to give up, at least for that moment, his inclination to accept Khrushchev's proposal Saturday morning of a public trade. Nevertheless, I tried to craft language that would meet McNamara's directive to make the best possible case for the move, pretending that it was in the interest of the Turks themselves, not just of the United States. This in the face of Hare's reports that any such action would destroy their trust in the United States and the alliance. I was usually pretty fast at drafting language. That was a major part of my job as a consultant from RAND in D.C., but I found this agonizingly slow going. I typed lines and paragraphs, tore the paper out and threw it away, tried again. I simply didn't believe what I was writing, and I hated doing it. It was a bureaucrat's job, elaborating positions that had been dictated from above, even when you strongly disagreed with them personally. But I was a RAND consultant, not an official, not an employee. I thought of saying I simply couldn't, wouldn't do it, leaving the building if necessary, going back to California. But I put that out of my mind. It would have seriously embarrassed Harry Rowan with Nitzer and McNamara. It was Harry who had brought me there and vouched for me. I tried to do it for him, not for them. But I wasn't getting anywhere. In real anguish, I was thinking of Kennedy and McNamara. They're blowing it. The president was going to take away the Turkish missiles. He was going to make the deal that Khrushchev demanded that morning. He was going to snatch defeat, the breakup of the NATO alliance, yielding on Berlin as well as Cuba, from the jaws of victory. I felt sure that Khrushchev was on the verge of giving way. Kennedy was backing off disastrously when he didn't have to. At one point, Nitzer came by the desk where I was writing and asked, "How's it going?" Uncharacteristically, I answered that query candidly. "Not so well, slowly." I remember feeling very tired as well as frustrated. My mind was turning slowly. Everybody was getting tired. I said to him, "I can't stand writing logic that Turks can pick apart." I'm not proud of this now, but I said Turks with full chauvinistic overtones, and I wasn't kidding. He said, "Well, keep at it," and walked off. I kept at it. Half an hour later, Harry came by and put me out of my misery. He said McNamara had drafted the cables himself. It was embarrassing. Nitzer must have told him he didn't have it yet. But I was relieved. Harry said to go home, and I went back to the hotel. I have never forgotten my thoughts as I looked at my face in the mirror above the bathroom sink in my hotel room, clutching the sink in my hands. It was half dark, lit only from the bedroom behind me. I was feeling a kind of horror. I felt I had just been part of something shameful, a transaction that shamed my country. These words were almost aloud in my head as I looked in the mirror. "I'm never coming back here. I'm never going to be in this position again." I had to do this, try to do this, for Harry. He was under orders. It was his job. But I'm not working for Harry anymore. I'm done. I'm not coming back to this town. I took off my clothes and fell into bed. The next morning, Sunday, I got up late. I had breakfast at the hotel and wandered into the ISA offices in the Pentagon about 10 o'clock. Everyone was celebrating, looking bemused. There'd been an announcement on the radio from Moscow an hour earlier that Khrushchev was in the process of removing the missiles from Cuba. He'd accepted Kennedy's proposal of the afternoon before. No mention was made of missiles in Turkey. It was pretty much what I'd expected before last night. I was glad to hear it, but I wasn't so surprised as the others, and I didn't feel any great jubilation. I felt relief, like everyone, but for a different reason. That McNamara's draft cables hadn't been acted on. I checked to see if they'd gone out. They hadn't, saving the day as I saw it. The NATO ministers were meeting at that moment, and the initial reports were that they were all joyously congratulating the United States for standing firm and triumphing. The Turks were especially happy. Chapter 13. Cuba. The Real Story. Khrushchev had backed off. He had not only accepted the blockade, but also removed his missiles, under threat of attack and without any compensating concession by JFK, except what I and most Americans assumed to be a meaningless promise not to invade Cuba. Harry Rowan had shared my confidence that the chance of nuclear war erupting from this confrontation was extremely low. I presumed President Kennedy and his lieutenants on the XCOM shared that confidence as well. Indeed, my notes reveal that sometime during that second week of the crisis, Harry had remarked to me, "I think the executive committee puts the chance of nuclear war very low, though they still may overestimate it by 10 times. They may put it at 1 in 100. He himself, he told me, would have said the odds were 1 in 1,000. But the day after the crisis ended on Monday, October 29th, he informed me that his boss, Paul Nitze, had just told him that he had put the chance of some form of nuclear war, if we had struck the missiles in Cuba, as fairly high. And his estimate of the risk, Nitze thought, was the lowest in the XCOM. Everyone else, he believed, put it higher. Harry had asked him what odds he would have given. Nitze's answer? 1 in 10. I remember vividly my reaction that Monday to this news from Harry. It came in 2 parts. First, puzzlement. Why would they put the risk that high? Nitze, of all people, was familiar with the new intelligence estimates. Could it be that he and the others, like the public at large, had not really absorbed the implications of the new intelligence, or didn't fully believe it? But then came a second reaction, slightly delayed. 1 in 10? Nuclear war. And we were doing what we were doing? What we had been doing on recommendations of the XCOM included the following. The blockade itself, at the risk of armed conflict with Soviet warships, forcing Soviet submarines to surface, high-level and low-level reconnaissance flights over Cuba, a large-scale airborne alert with significant risk of accidents involving nuclear weapons, continuing reconnaissance even after several planes were fired on and one shot down on Saturday, and full preparations, if they were wholly a bluff they fooled us, for invasion and airstrike. With the exception of the dangerous airborne alert, every one of these actions was illegal under international law, a violation of the UN Charter, unless as an act of war sanctioned by the UN Security Council. More significantly, every one of them threatened at least conventional armed conflict with the Soviet Union. I myself had accepted the general wisdom that the stakes in this confrontation, in global political terms, were quite high, enough to justify certain risks. I was prepared to support non-nuclear threats, willing even to take some risks of conventional war. I was, in short, a cold warrior working for the U.S. Defense Department. My emotion Saturday night on the thought of an unnecessary missile trade made that as clear as it could be, not least to myself. But to be willing to take an estimated 10% chance of nuclear war? In order to avoid a public trade of the Turkish missiles? Who were these people I was working for? Were they all insane? Later, Robert McNamara would reveal something of his state of mind on October 27th. The Saturday before the Sunday in which Khrushchev announced withdrawal of the missiles, and a U-2 was shot down, I remember leaving the White House at the end of that Saturday. It was a beautiful fall day, and thinking that might well be the last sunset I saw. You couldn't tell what was going to follow. Could I have been that far off in my own belief that nuclear war was extremely unlikely? Could they have been right? The answer to both is yes, though for different reasons than most of them supposed. The fact is that on Saturday, October 27th, 1962, a chain of events was in motion that might have come close to ending civilization. How close? A handbreadth. That is despite the fact, as I have come to believe, that both leaders, Khrushchev and Kennedy, were determined to avoid armed conflict. That both, in fact, were prepared to settle on the other's terms if necessary rather than go to war. And yet they each hoped, by threatening war, to achieve a better bargain. For the sake of a better deal, they both were willing to postpone by hours or days the settlement that each was willing to make. And meanwhile, during those hours, their subordinates, unaware that they were supporting a pure bluff in a game of bargaining, were taking military actions that could unleash an unstoppable train of events, ultimately pulling the trigger on a doomsday machine. A note. For more than half a century, I have done my best to learn about this crisis and to learn from it. The scholarship of many others has been crucial to my current understanding of it, along with the opening of files both in America and Russia, both mostly decades after the events and continuing up to this moment. But I have read all these contributions from the perspective of my classified 9-month study of nuclear crises, mainly this one, triggered precisely by my own participation in it, and the challenge to understand how its dangers could have been, as I steadily discovered, so much greater than I believed at the time. I intend to place on my website, Ellsberg.net/doomsday/Cuban Missile Crisis, as many of my own files on the crisis as possible. I could, but probably won't at this point, write a book as long as this one, solely on what I think I've learned from my study of the Cuban Missile Crisis, and what the evidence is for my conclusion so far. But I'm not going to present much of that evidence or reasoning here, or argue for it. What follows are my own inferences, many of them, I warn, unfamiliar and probably controversial even to scholars. And for the purpose of this book, I'm going to focus mainly on what bears on the real risk of nuclear war. For that reason, I'll skip over not only the first 9 days of the official crisis, but its real origins, about which my understanding, not only in 1962 but in 1964 and for a decade or two after that, was flawed or mistaken in almost every important respect. In particular, that relates to Khrushchev's incentives to initiate his secret deployments to Cuba. Reducing the strategic imbalance, exposed by the Gilpatric speech and otherwise, was not the only or even main or triggering cause of his secret policy, as I and virtually all scholars and journalists had supposed for more than one decade, and in important respects several decades. It was not until 1975 and 1976, with the report of the Senator Church Committee on Covert Operations, including the massive 1962 Mongoose Project against Cuba, and then a dozen years after that, with investigative scholarship on U.S. contingency plans and exercise rehearsals for invading Cuba in 1962 by the historian James Hirschberg, that I learned the basis in reality of Khrushchev's claims, especially in his 1970 memoir, that he had been anguished, with good reason, at the thought that he was about to lose Cuba to renewed U.S. aggression. That realistic obsession was a major part of the answer, not once reflected in the Kennedy tapes of the meetings of the XCOM, many of whose members were not cleared either for Mongoose or for the early October contingency plans for invasion, of the question JFK disingenuously raised to his supposedly advisory group. Why has Khrushchev done this? For my own reflections on this and other matters relating to the early aspects of the crisis, which in reality began well before, almost a year before October 16, 1962, see my website, Ellsberg.net/doomsday/Cuban Missile Crisis. By Thursday, October 25th, the day after the blockade was instituted, Khrushchev decided that his effort had failed and that he would have to remove the missiles from Cuba. Despite his threats of defying piracy, he didn't want to challenge the blockade, fearing that Kennedy's willingness to risk armed conflict with the Soviet Union on the high seas increased the credibility that the United States would attack the missiles if he didn't remove them. That, subsequently, would call for a response from the Soviets extending far beyond the Caribbean, raising even more risk of all-out war. Khrushchev had not entered into this project with a desire to encounter such risks. His hope as of Thursday morning in Moscow was to withdraw with as little loss of face as possible, preferably with something to show for the effort. At the very least a non-invasion pledge, but probably a public trade for the Turkish missiles, or perhaps even more. Perhaps the IRBMs in Italy and Britain, or all U.S. forces in Turkey, perhaps even concessions on Berlin. In the meantime, he continued to press his forces in Cuba to continue the installation of the missiles on a crash basis. Presumably, his aim was to improve the terms of an eventual bargain by increasing the stakes of any U.S. attack on the missiles, thereby increasing Kennedy's motivation to strike a deal. The danger of this strategy lay in increasing U.S. military pressure to attack the missiles before they all became operational. And since that would likely be followed by invasion, Khrushchev might end up triggering the very event the missiles and other equipment had been intended to forestall. On the other hand, the stronger his hand, the more likely that Kennedy might seek a diplomatic solution. And there were private indications from the Kennedys that he was leaning in that direction. The morning after the president's speech on October 22nd, Robert Kennedy had sent word by two separate channels to Georgi Bolshakov, a Soviet intelligence agent operating under journalistic cover, that his brother was open to removing the NATO missiles from Turkey in exchange for the removal of the missiles in Cuba. It is not clear when, if ever, the message reached Khrushchev. But as the Soviet ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin would reveal in 1990, RFK delivered the same message to him in a private meeting on Thursday night. That very morning, Walter Lippmann had published a syndicated column suggesting such a trade. Although for a quarter century Lippmann was depicted as an interfering meddler, the Soviets had every reason to believe he had been writing with Kennedy's authorization, as was likely the case. On this basis, Khrushchev dictated a message to Kennedy in the presence of the Presidium and with its suggestions, proposing that the crisis be resolved by a non-invasion pledge from the United States and the removal of the weapons you call offensive from both Cuba and Turkey. But this message was not sent Friday. Before it was sent, alarming indications came from a variety of sources, and in particular from Castro, that an invasion was imminent, possibly within the next 24 hours or the following day. In face of that, Khrushchev dictated, again in the presence of the Presidium, a longer message indicating that a pledge of non-invasion would be enough. There was no mention of Turkey. After delays for coding, transmission, and decoding, that message arrived in sections at the White House and Pentagon Friday evening, though it had been sent that morning. It was read happily by the Kennedys and much of the XCOM, who went to bed that night with relief. Less so by the Joint Chiefs, who were eager to invade. A non-invasion pledge was anathema to them in any case. Worst of all as a resolution of this crisis, which I suspect they regarded as the best justification for an invasion that would ever come along. But by Saturday morning in Moscow, Khrushchev had come to doubt the immediate imminence of the invasion, and decided to try for a better deal. Thus, with the agreement of the Presidium, he updated the earlier composed message proposing a trade with the Turkish missiles and sent that. The arrival of this second message caused confusion and consternation among the XCOM Saturday morning. Had Khrushchev possibly been sidelined by a more hardline faction? After much debate, it was decided that Kennedy should ignore the second letter and simply respond to the earlier message, agreeing to settle the crisis on the basis of a pledge not to invade Cuba. No one now had much hope that this would be sufficient to get the missiles out, not the Joint Chiefs, not McNamara, and not Kennedy. He now thought it unlikely that they would accept this latest offer, even though it purported to accept one that Khrushchev appeared to have proposed the night before. When confirmation arrived on Saturday afternoon that an American U-2 had been shot down over Cuba that morning by a Soviet surface-to-air missile, SAM, the XCOM assumed that this was a deliberate escalation by Khrushchev, a further signal that the Soviet position was hardening, and that they were more willing to take risks and less prone to accept terms that had seemed possible even the night before. And yet, early Sunday morning, October 28, 1962, Moscow radio began broadcasting Khrushchev's full acceptance of Kennedy's proposal, withdrawal of the missiles in exchange for a non-invasion pledge. This unexpectedly rapid resolution on these terms came as an intoxicating surprise. The initial inferences drawn were that Khrushchev had simply given up on achieving his more favorable terms. Khrushchev's loss of nerve, as Dean Acheson put it later. It appeared a victory for Kennedy's firmness throughout that week, evidenced not only in his public and private statements, but also in the blockade and the urgent preparations for invasion. The lesson drawn was, take a firm stand, prepare to back it up, and the Soviets will back down. A different light was shed on this 7 years later, when Robert Kennedy's posthumous memoir of the crisis, 13 Days, revealed that on Saturday night he had met with Ambassador Dobrynin and conveyed what amounted to an ultimatum. The missiles must begin to be removed within 48 hours or the United States would remove them by force. This was accompanied by what amounted to a private deal. If the missiles were removed from Cuba, the missiles in Turkey would also be withdrawn in 4 or 5 months, though only if the Soviets did not reveal this explicit but secret understanding. For military commanders who had regarded the failure of the crisis to lead to invasion as an intense disappointment, this last revelation was one more proof of Kennedy's weakness and appeasement. Others found that the real lesson, after all, was the effectiveness of negotiation and compromise. A number of former members of the XCOM, in a joint column published in Time in 1982, maintained that it was the secret concession to Khrushchev that had led to a swift resolution of the crisis. Since then, it has been widely assumed that this secret offer was critical to ending the confrontation. But that is almost surely untrue. The secrecy of the deal, RFK even rejected a proposal by Dobrynin the next day that the oral understanding be confirmed in writing, meant that it offered Khrushchev virtually nothing to soften the humiliation of his retreat. He couldn't even take credit for this deal to his own presidium, let alone, say, to the Chinese, who mocked him for his craven surrender. It has since turned out that Khrushchev had announced his decision to concede to the presidium before he received by phone, later in the same meeting, a report of RFK's threats and offer. In any case, I believe that this promise, even though it was meticulously carried out by the Americans, would have had no effect at all on Khrushchev's decision. And yet the ultimatum by RFK wouldn't entirely explain Khrushchev's abrupt concession any more than the hollow offer of a secret deal. That ultimatum had allowed at least another day, perhaps two, for more bargaining. Even 24 hours, the time requested by RFK for a decision, though the hard deadline was 48, allowed time for Khrushchev to stand on or reiterate his own latest demand for a public trade. Why hadn't he taken that time to renew his proposal, or at least ask for direct response to it? Even in Moscow, some were struck by the special haste that Sunday. Fyodor Bulatsky, Khrushchev's speechwriter, later recalled for me some details of that day. "They were very, very nervous at this time," Bulatsky told me, speaking of the drafters of the October 28th message, with whom he had been in close touch. This letter was not drafted in the Kremlin, nor in the Politburo. It was drafted at Khrushchev's dacha, by a very small group. As soon as it was done, they ran it to the radio station. That is to say, they sent it by car, very fast. As a matter of fact, the car ran into some trouble on the way, an obstruction which delayed it. When it arrived, the manager of the station himself ran down the steps, snatched the message from the hands of the man in the car, and ran up the steps to broadcast it immediately. Bulatsky didn't know, he said, why they seemed in such a hurry. In fact, there were good reasons for a sense of urgency in Moscow. One of these I learned from Robert F. Kennedy in 1964, in the course of a highly classified interagency study I was conducting of communication between governments in nuclear crises. He told me in more detail than was made public in his memoir that at the direction of his brother on the evening of Saturday, October 27, 1962, he began a secret discussion at the Justice Department with Dobrynin by impressing on him the serious implications of the attacks that day on American reconnaissance aircraft. I said, "You have drawn first blood, and that's a very serious matter," he told me he had said to Dobrynin. I said the president had decided against advice, strongly from the military, but not only from the military, not to respond militarily to that attack. But he, Dobrynin, should know that if another plane was shot at, we would shoot back. I said we would be continuing to fly reconnaissance missions over Cuba. We had to. The shooting had to stop. If one more plane was shot at, we wouldn't just attack the site that had fired at it. We would take out all the SAMs and anti-aircraft and probably all the missiles. And that would almost surely be followed by an invasion. I asked Kennedy, "Did you name a deadline?" He said, "Yes, 48 hours." I wanted to be sure I understood. So he was giving them 48 hours. He cut in right away, correcting me. He said, "Unless they shot a plane sooner, in which case we would go right away." So there were two separate threats or warnings, I said. They had just 2 days to start removing the missiles or we would remove them. That's if no more planes were shot at or shot down. But if we lost another plane, the attack would start immediately, right after that. He said, "That's right." The shooting down of the U-2 plane over Cuba on Saturday morning had certainly represented an ominous escalation of the crisis. As it turned out, it was the first and only deliberate acknowledged killing of an American soldier by Soviet troops in the entire Cold War. But aside from the U-2, we were also flying low-level reconnaissance planes, crisscrossing the island every 2 hours, producing sonic booms and causing general panic. Cuban anti-aircraft guns couldn't reach a U-2 at 70,000 feet, but they could hit these low-level reconnaissance planes. Nevertheless, on Khrushchev's urging, the Cubans had refrained from firing before Saturday morning. On Saturday, this changed for Castro. Convinced that the recon flights were preparing for an imminent invasion, Castro rejected Khrushchev's cautions and ordered his anti-aircraft to fire, damaging one low-flying plane. Given the assumption among the ex-com that Castro was a puppet under the iron control of Khrushchev, it didn't occur to anyone that the Cubans could take such action without Soviet authorization. Yet they had. At the same time, a Soviet-manned SAM had fired onto U-2, shooting it down. As transcripts of the White House meeting on October 27th make clear, no participant questioned that both firings represented a deliberate escalation, a change of orders by Khrushchev himself. In reality, according to Burlatsky, Khrushchev had given very strong, very precise orders that Soviet officers should make no provocation, initiate no attack in Cuba. In particular, the firing of the SAM that destroyed Major Anderson's U-2, he said emphatically, was done absolutely without the direction of Khrushchev and the Soviet high command. In fact, it was done against their orders, and Khrushchev was very apprehensive about the American reaction. All this has been confirmed by revelations decades after the crisis, by other participants and Soviet files. With no American advisor having guessed this possibility, RFK's mission Saturday evening was in part to induce Khrushchev to recognize the dangers of his supposed decision to escalate, and to refrain from further attacks on reconnaissance planes, starting with the low-level flights scheduled for the next day. This warning was no bluff. The October 27th transcript reveals that it conveyed accurately to the Soviets the consensus of the White House discussions that afternoon. The Joint Chiefs were already furious that Kennedy had decided not to retaliate immediately for the attacks on our aircraft. When he returned to the White House that night, RFK wrote, "The President was not optimistic, nor was I. He ordered 24 troop carrier squadrons of the Air Force Reserve to active duty. They would be necessary for an invasion." He had not abandoned hope, but what hope there was now rested with Khrushchev's revising his course within the next few hours. It was hope, not expectation. The expectation was a military confrontation by Tuesday and possibly Sunday. But the warning almost surely had more impact than intended, for a reason the President and his advisers did not know and could not even imagine. Very simply, the deterrent warning was directed to the wrong party. Even if he could expect to control future SAM firings, which was in question at this point, Khrushchev knew he had no influence at all over the Cuban anti-aircraft artillerymen, who threatened low-flying flights. They had begun firing on Saturday morning on the direct orders of Fidel Castro, who was determined to defend the sovereignty of Cuban airspace, regardless of Soviet desires to avoid provoking American retaliation. As Castro put it to Tad Schultz in 1984, It was we who gave the order to fire against the low-level flights. We had simply presented our viewpoints to the Soviets, our opposition to low-level flights, and we ordered our batteries to fire on them. The Cuban gunners had never fired at live targets before. They were getting closer during the day on Saturday. Castro later said he was sure they would have destroyed at least one plane by Sunday. As for the downing of the U-2, it wasn't immediately clear to Khrushchev how this had happened. All he knew was that it had not been done by his authority and was against his desire. He thought mistakenly it had come about under the influence of Castro, whom he berated the next day. In fact, the order came from the local SAM commander, a general, though he was under orders not to fire without authorization from General Issa Pliev, the commander-in-chief of Soviet forces in Cuba. He had been carried away by the action of the Cuban anti-aircraft batteries wildly firing, for the first time, at low-level reconnaissance planes. Suspecting that an invasion was underway and unable to reach Pliev, he had acted on his own authority and gave the order to fire. As Khrushchev's son, Sergei, later told me, this was a turning point for his father. He knew things were getting out of his control. He could not control Castro. And he now had to wonder whether Soviet-manned SAMs were under his control. Even before he heard Dobrynin's account of his meeting with Robert Kennedy, which could only confirm his fears and the urgency of acting on them, Khrushchev could only conclude that he might well lose both his missiles and SAMs, with heavy Soviet casualties and the likelihood of further escalation, soon after low-flying U.S. reconnaissance planes entered Cuban airspace on Sunday, perhaps at first light, less than 12 hours away in the Caribbean. If there was any way to avert this, it could only be to announce his acceptance of Kennedy's Saturday night proposal and to start dismantling missiles before another shoot-down and the subsequent reprisal occurred. That much I had come to know in my classified study in 1964. It seemed enough to explain why Khrushchev had folded his hand before the 24 or 48-hour deadline Kennedy had sent his brother to deliver. But there was even more that Khrushchev knew and Kennedy didn't. Secrets Khrushchev had chosen not to reveal at the time and that remained unknown to any Americans, including me, for 25 years or more. First, that the number of Soviet troops in Cuba was not 7,000, as we had first supposed, or even 17,000, as the CIA estimated at the end of the crisis, but 42,000. And second, that along with SAMs and ballistic missiles, they had been secretly equipped with over 100 tactical nuclear weapons, warheads included. So far as we knew, Khrushchev had never sent tactical, or until now strategic weapons with nuclear warheads outside the Soviet Union. Yet not only had he done this, but also the Presidium had agreed to delegate authority to local commanders to use them against an invasion fleet, without direct orders from Moscow. That delegation, by Soviets supposedly obsessed with centralized political control of the military, was virtually unimaginable to American intelligence analysts and officials. Yet it had been agreed to throughout the period of deployment prior to Kennedy's speech on October 22nd by the entire Presidium. This was reportedly on the theory that since these limited-range tactical weapons could not reach Florida or threaten other parts of the United States, their use by local Soviet commanders against an invasion force could be trusted not to escalate to all-out war, as fat-headed a belief by the Presidium as the earlier assurance by General Sergei Beriusov to Khrushchev that IRBMs would look to overhead reconnaissance like palm trees. Although this prior authorization had been withdrawn following Kennedy's speech on October 22nd, it was understood by Soviet commanders that in the heat of combat and with communications from Moscow interrupted, the new orders not to fire without explicit direction from Moscow were uncertain to be obeyed. That would correspond to what actually happened with the SAM Saturday morning. When Robert McNamara learned about this in 1992, 30 years later, he noted, "We don't need to speculate what would have happened. It would have been an absolute disaster for the world. No one should believe that a U.S. force could have been attacked by tactical nuclear warheads without responding with nuclear warheads. And where would it have ended? In utter disaster." Khrushchev knew the weapons were there, and he had no reason to believe that JFK knew that. those weapons had not been intended as a deterrent, but rather to defend against an invading fleet. In fact, our reconnaissance had spotted only one weapon, during or after the crisis, which it regarded as dual-capable, probably without a nuclear warhead. Nevertheless, Khrushchev knew that by dawn's light on Sunday, low-flying reconnaissance planes would resume their flights over Cuba, that Castro could not be restrained from taking what he regarded as defensive measures, and that when one of those planes was shot down, it would trigger a U.S. attack on the SAMs, the missiles, and more than likely, an invasion force that would have no idea what was in store for it. The invasion would almost surely trigger a two-sided nuclear exchange that would, with near certainty, expand to massive U.S. nuclear attacks on the Soviet Union. Khrushchev's order to dismantle the missiles arrived in Cuba 36 hours ahead of RFK's ultimatum deadline. The dismantling began at 5 a.m. The race to the radio station for the public broadcast announcement, bypassing slower diplomatic channels, came a few hours later. Khrushchev, as he expected, paid a heavy political price for withdrawing abruptly from what he had discovered to be Cuban roulette. Yet surely he was wise to do so, without awaiting one more day's spin of the chamber. Explaining his decision suddenly to remove his forces from dangers to which he should never have exposed them, Khrushchev said later about that Saturday night, "A smell of scorching hung in the air." The fact is, JFK and his brother never lived to know what Khrushchev had done about the Cuban defiance, or the insubordination of a SAM commander, or the tactical nuclear weapons on the island. But more was happening that neither leader knew that Saturday afternoon, while they were both still postponing agreement, haggling for better terms. The same day that a Soviet SAM downed an American U-2, a Soviet submarine in the Caribbean armed with a nuclear torpedo believed it was being attacked by American destroyers. It was 4:59 in the afternoon of October 27th that sonar operators on the American destroyer USS Beale detected the submerged Soviet submarine B-59 and began to bombard it with practice depth charges. A carrier, five destroyers, and several anti-submarine helicopters had their quarry cornered in a narrow sector of the Caribbean, and were signaling, as they supposed, for it to come up and identify itself, a token of vulnerability and surrender. Otherwise they could wait it out until it had to come up amid them, running low on oxygen and electricity, to recharge its batteries. The crews and the ships on the surface were exulting in their first live anti-submarine practice against a Soviet target. No one among the ships on the surface, nor any member of the XCOM that had directed this harassment, was aware or even suspected that the Foxtrot-class diesel submarine they were baiting was armed, for the first time in the operation of such vessels, with a nuclear-tipped torpedo, whose 10 to 15 kiloton Hiroshima yield warhead was capable of destroying several or all of those ships in one blast. And the commander and crew in that submarine were coming to believe they were under attack. The blockade had begun 3 days earlier, with the utmost concern on President Kennedy's part about just such an encounter. The 10 a.m. XCOM meeting on Wednesday, October 24th, produced what Robert Kennedy later described as the most intense moment of the crisis, precisely on the issue of signaling procedures with respect to Soviet submarines. At that same moment, as the quarantine became effective, the Strategic Air Command moved its alert level from defense condition DEFCON 3 to DEFCON 2, the level just below readiness for an imminent general nuclear war, for the first and only time in the Cold War. SAC Commander-in-Chief General Thomas Power had, on his own initiative, sent out the execute orders for this change in the clear, uncoded, to intimidate the Soviets. Nearly 1,500 strategic bombers with nuclear weapons aboard were on alert around the world. And for the first time, 1/8 of SAC was on continuous rotating airborne alert. One nuclear-armed bomber taking off as another finished a tour and landed. McNamara told the meeting that two ships, both possibly carrying offensive weapons, were approaching the quarantine line, and that there were submarines close to each of them. The plan was for a destroyer to intercept one of the subs. McNamara and General Taylor explained that a brand new signaling arrangement had been sent to the Soviets the night before. by dropping practice depth charges, in effect hand grenades, which could supposedly even hit the submarine without causing it damage, we would signal to the submarine that it should surface. They presumed, they said, that the Soviets had received the message and passed it on, but they couldn't be sure. In fact, the four submarines' captains in the Caribbean all denied in later interviews that they had received any such message. In his handwritten notes of that morning, Robert Kennedy said, "These few minutes were the time of greatest worry by the President. His hand went up to his face and covered his mouth, and he closed his fist. His eyes were tense, almost gray, and we just stared at each other across the table." In later accounts, he quoted the President, "Isn't there some way we can avoid having our first exchange with a Russian submarine? Almost anything but that. No, there's too much danger to our ships. There's no alternative," said McNamara. As Robert Kennedy observed, "We had come to the time of final decision. I felt we were on the edge of a precipice with no way off. 1,000 miles away in the vast expanse of the Atlantic Ocean, the final decisions were going to be made in the next few minutes. President Kennedy had initiated the course of events, but he no longer had control over them." Just then, John McCone, Director of Central Intelligence, broke in with confirmation that 6 Soviet ships approaching the quarantine line had stopped dead in the water or had reversed course. Robert Kennedy continues in his account, "The meeting droned on, but everyone looked like a different person. For a moment the world had stood still, and now it was going around again." But unknown to Robert Kennedy in his lifetime, or to any of the others on the XCOM for decades, the moment of truth had only been postponed. There had been no interceptions or even signaling to submarines on Wednesday the 24th. The President gave orders to lay off that day, lest we attack a vessel that had actually been ordered to return by Khrushchev. But the Navy energetically continued to track Soviet submarines in the area in succeeding days, with the intention, as McNamara had explained to the President, of harassing them to the point of their leaving the vicinity. In the course of the next week, Navy destroyers, carriers, and helicopters had located precisely at various times 3 of the 4 Foxtrot submarines that had been dispatched to the Caribbean. None of them responded to the mock depth charge signals to surface and identify themselves. None of them, it turned out, interpreted the explosions as signals at all, not having received any information to this effect from Moscow, with which they were only intermittently in touch. Nor did they experience them as harmless. All 3, in fact, believed themselves at certain points to be under attack. On 2 of these submarines, the commanding officer ordered the special weapon, the torpedo with a Hiroshima-sized nuclear explosive power, to be readied for a retaliatory response. Because the crew had not been told what they were carrying, it was referred to only as the special weapon. The 2nd of these incidents actually occurred on October 30th. 2 days after the world had concluded that the crisis was over. American surveillance and efforts to force Soviet submarines to surface continued until the quarantine was ended on November 20th. But the submarines, still trying to evade detection, had not received messages as to whether war had begun or not. Submarine B-130, under Captain Nikolai Shumkov, the same sub whose temporary detection 6 days earlier had brought President Kennedy's hand to his mouth, submerged suddenly on October 30th on being spotted by a destroyer, but could do so only slowly because 2 of its diesel engines had failed. The destroyer passed overhead, the sonar dome on its prow missing the conning tower on the sub's deck by only a few meters. Shumkov wondered whether the destroyer was trying to ram it, possibly to present it afterward as an accident, unless perhaps they were already at war. According to Shumkov, one of the depth charges landed a direct hit on the hull, and its explosion damaged the depth steering wheel. At the same time, he received a report from a compartment of the submarine, reporting they had experienced a leak, which was later repaired. As Shumkov said in a later interview, "When they blew up those grenades, I thought they were bombing us." In the account by Peter Hutchthausen, Shumkov ordered the flooding of 4 torpedo tubes, preparatory to firing, including the tube for the special weapon. he quickly got a call from the special weapons security officer in the forward torpedo tube, who warned him, "Sir, we can't arm that torpedo without specific instructions from the Special Weapons Directorate of the Main Navy Staff." Shumkov cut him off. "Why the hell don't you dial the headquarters on your little telephone and ask them? Or doesn't it work 100 meters below the sea?" He ordered the young officer, "Look, just do as you're told, and I'll handle the permission." As the